topic for tonight is the tenure of Golda Meir as Prime Minister of Israel, 1969 through 1974, but tonight we'll just discuss from the election of 1969 until the summer of 1973, and then next time we'll discuss the rumblings towards war before the Yom Kippur War. So, next week? What's next week? I don't get a break. Okay. So, the election for the 7th Knesset took place on October 28, 1969. And this election was one where the winner was without doubt going to be the alignment. And this was the second version of the alignment. If you remember, in 1965, there was the first version of the alignment. There was the Mapai and Achdut HaAvodah coming together, and they won, and Levi Eshkol remained prime minister. But Rafi was a breakaway. Rafi was Ben-Gurion and Dayan and Peres. But Rafi rejoined the Mapai and became the Labor Party. The Labor Party existed for 1 year, and in 1969, the Mapam decided to join the fold too, not in the Labor Party, but in an alignment for the election. So you have the whole left side of the aisle, pretty much, in one electoral block. And the goal was to win a majority of the seats in the Knesset and have no coalition government, just to rule, to have absolute majority and to win the day. It didn't work out that way. They won 56 seats, but that's still a tremendous amount. No party has ever won that many, and no party ever will again, because that's just not the way Israel exists, certainly not today when it's so factionalized. Now parties don't even get 40. They're lucky if they get in the low 30s. But this election also had parties that had never been seen before. So I'm going to run down the list, and I'm going to explain to you who's new and why they're not really all that new. So the alignment won 56. Gachal, Menachem Begin's party, won 26. The Mafdal, the National Religious Party, won 12. And then all the other parties won a very small number of seats. There only were three significant parties: the left of the alignment, the right of Gachal, and the NRP. Everyone else had bupkis, basically. The Aguda had 4. The Independent Liberals had 4. The Nationalist, which I'll talk about in a second, had 4. The Arabs, Maki, which was really Raqqa, the Arab version of the communists, had 3. The other Arab parties who were the Mapai satellites had 2 plus 2 is 4. Meri, which was Uri Avneri's radical camp, had 2. The Free Center, which was a new party, had 2. Poli Aguda had 2. And the old line Maki, the Jewish communist, Moshe Sneh, had 1. So basically, there were a bunch of little parties that don't mean anything. Only the three big parties mattered at all. So who are these new parties? The Nationalist. What are they? Answer: David Ben-Gurion. David Ben-Gurion was a curmudgeonly old guy at that point. He was 83, and like he went, might as well be 183, because he had already burned all of his bridges with his old collaborators and colleagues. He left Mapai in 65, and he left Rafi in 68, because the rest of Rafi decided to join the Labor Party. So he had no one. He was sitting alone as a one-man faction for a year in the Knesset, and not even showing up to the Knesset all that often, because he preferred to be in Stebokar in the Negev. He'd come to Yerushalayim once in a while to engage in Knesset affairs, but basically he was a loner at that point, out of the halls of power. But yet, he wasn't ready to give up completely. He wanted one more go-around, one more hurrah in a Knesset election cycle. And so he establishes the Rishima Mamlachtit, which can be translated in English as either the Nationalist or the Statelist. And this party had two things going for it: statism, Mamlachtiyut, which had been Ben-Gurion's slogan all along since the beginning of the state, and the man himself, David Ben-Gurion, just the figure, the face, the hair, the bald head. That's enough to attract enough votes to get 4 seats in the Knesset. Who joined with him? So interestingly, his old buddy, Isser Harel, the former head of the Mossad, decided to go into Knesset and was a member of the state list, and a few other fellows whose names you're not going to remember. So it was Ben-Gurion and Isser Harel who were the only ones of any consequence. But Ben-Gurion was getting on in years and decided to retire completely in 1970. He gives one last speech in May of 1970 and resigns his Knesset seat after 22 years in the Knesset, since the day Israel was founded. He goes down to the Negev to stay Boker. Sometimes he goes up to Tel Aviv to an apartment, and he rides out his last few years into the sunset. In 1971, he turns 85, and there's a nice party for him. that was thrown by his old colleagues, and he makes shalom with Golda. After 6 years of them cursing each other and being bitter foes, and this was after 30, 40 years of collaboration where they were, close colleagues, so after 6 years of being very antagonistic, finally they made shalom. But Golda acknowledged that it's a shame because Ben-Gurion wasn't completely functioning upstairs anymore. So it wasn't the same Ben-Gurion. He had become sedated with mental decline. If he had his full faculties, he probably still would have been cursing her. So that's only a halva nechama, you know? And he died on December 1st, 1973, shortly after the conclusion of the Yom Kippur War. Was he lucid during the war, and did he know what was going on? Not entirely clear. Probably he was foggy at that point and didn't really know what was going on. But suffice it to say, the National List was his last political baby, and the irony of ironies is that the National List, the Rishima Mamlachtit, ends up joining what political party? The Likud. That Ben-Gurion's party becomes the Likud. Yes, in 1973, the Likud is formed by Ariel Sharon. He's the person who does all the legwork to put it together. Now, we'll get to this in a few weeks. We discussed the 73 elections. But what is the Likud? It was Begin's Gcherut with the liberals of Gachal, together with the Greater Land of Israel movement, the Free Center, which I'll talk about in a second now, and the State List. So Ben-Gurion's last political home ends up being a forerunner of the Likud. Little known fact. Okay, so what was the Free Center, another party that was brand new in 1969? It was founded by Shmuel Tamir. Does that name at all ring a bell, Shmuel Tamir? It shouldn't, because he wasn't exactly... Okay, he was important in the 50s and 60s. Actually, he was the justice minister in the late 70s. So he was a member of the Irgun and a real right-wing ideologue, who was the lawyer in the Kastner trial. If you recall, we discussed the Kastner trial. He was the right-wing lawyer who was defending Grunewald, which was attacking Kastner and the Mapai government. He was like a rabble-rouser who was always poking holes into the left side of the aisle. Well, in 1966, he was kicked out of Gachal. Why was he expelled from the party? So we haven't been discussing too many domestic issues or social policy. We've mostly been discussing war and peace and the bigger issues, religion and state. But social policy, he supported an abortion law. He was in favor of changing the abortion law in Israel to allow for non-therapeutic abortions for reasons of socioeconomic concern. If a family has, seven children and can't afford an eighth, so abortion. There's an apocryphal story that he went to Rabbi Aryeh Levin to get support for this, and he didn't get the support. And the story went that a couple had come to him many, many years before and asked for the same question: we have already other children, we can't afford it, blah, blah, blah. Rabbi, can we have an abortion? And he said, no, because your child is going to accomplish something in this world. And so Shmuel Tamir said to him, no, and did that guy accomplish anything? And he said, it's you. So...
And the answer was no.
Right.
I
and he still persisted?
I don't know if this is a true story, it's an apocryphal story, but that's the story. So Tamir was kicked out of Gachal because Gachal was basically socially conservative, not on all issues, but on most issues, and abortion wasn't going to go over well. So the other issue was that who ran the Chirut party? Who's the leader of the party? Menachem Begin. Most parties have central committees where the leader is periodically elected, and it might be the same guy again and again, but you get elected, and it's a fair fight for who's going to hold the number one slot in the Knesset list. Somehow, Gachal or Chirut really never was that way. It was a close-knit group of people who had fought in the Irgun and who had been together since the pre-state era. So Begin could never seriously be challenged, but Tamir wanted to challenge him. And so he broke away and established the so-called Free Center, which won two seats. Later, this Free Center would fold back into the Likud in the 1970s, and Tamir would be the justice minister in Menachem Begin's first cabinet in 1977 to 1980. But now, he's running his own operations with a little boutique party. Okay. Notice the Arabs still, the Arab parties still exist, the old Mapai satellite parties. Their time is coming to an end eventually. After the Six-Day War, and certainly after the Yom Kippur War, the Arabs will want to vote for their own real political parties, not for dummy parties that are arranged by a Zionist leadership at the top. And lastly, we should note that the opposition, well, who's the leader of the opposition? Rabbi Yitzchak Meir Levin. Now, the leader of the opposition is usually the leader of the largest party not in the coalition. The Aguda had 4 seats. How could that be the largest party not in the coalition? Answer, it's almost a wall-to-wall coalition. Remember, the Six-Day War was an emergency. And in an emergency, you want everybody to get together. Okay, national unity government, national emergency government. All the major parties, all the Zionist parties, come on in, we'll govern together. Golda maintained that, even though the war was 2 years in the past. And after the election, she would want to continue to have that wall-to-wall coalition because it was helpful in fending off pressure from the international community, even including from the Americans, and especially from the Americans. So with voices in the coalition ranging from as far left as the Doves of the Labor Party to the right-wingers of the Gachal, it's not likely that there will be any consensus on matters of war and peace. Which means what ends up happening? The status quo. Nothing happens. And nothing happening might be just fine. But it's not fine for who? For the Americans and for the internationals who want to pressure Israel in doing something on the diplomatic front. So it's starting. It's starting, and it will not really pick up until the 73 election, when it will prove impossible for the NRP to join the government, at least not right away, because the electorate of the NRP are now listening to the right-wing, territorially right-wing rabbis, and the young people are excited about Greater Israel, as opposed to the older voters who were in their 50s and 60s and 70s, who had been classically dovish, and whose opinions might not have changed, but their time has come and gone, and the young people are the exciting ones and are running the show in the party. Okay, I just want to show you a few ads from the 69 election cycle. So, as I said, the alignment was going to win. That was never in doubt. But what is the alignment? What does the alignment stand for? So, here's the leader. Tein la et kolcha v'chazek et kola. Give her your voice, your vote, and strengthen her voice. Rak al hanhagat emet if shali smoke. Only on emet can you rely. What is emet?
That was the acronym.
Okay, so emet was aleph for the Mapai, Mem for the Mapam, and Taf for Achdut HaAvodah, became Emet, you know, vote for the truth. So, this ad is not like the Ben-Gurion ads from the previous cycles, because if you notice, she doesn't look, it's not designed for her to look like Chairman Mao, or like a perfect picture. The hair is flowing in the wind, the face has a scowl on it, it's a rough and tumble picture. It's not intended to be this elite figure at the top, an untouchable figure. Everyone knew that she had been sick from before, but they didn't know how the extent of her illness, and that was largely kept quiet. And actually, for the 5 years she was prime minister, she was fairly vigorous and traveled around the world. So by the standards of the time, for a woman in her early 70s as a cancer patient, she was a real go-getter. And she did it. People were shocked at how much she was able to take on in terms of workload and travel. Okay, now let's go to the other figures in the alignment. Moshe Dayan. Okay, Moshe Dayan, the hero of the 56 war, of the 67 war. You put him on the newspaper ad because it'll win over voters. And what does it say? Moshe Dayan has a quote. Drushim lanu emuna amuka b'yudenu ba'aretz. What is demanded of us is a deep and abiding faith in our destiny in this land. Lehavtiach medina la'am ha'yudi, to provide a state for the Jewish nation. Unechonut l'ma'asim ha'mitchayavim min ha'amuna, and the willingness to act upon whatever consequences are the result of that faith. Nechonut l'ilachem lehavek cherav kol ha'kashim, and the willingness to fight and battle despite all the odds. What word is missing here?
God.
Forget about God. Is Moshe Dayan here? No. What word? No, not Israel. What word that starts with a P?
Peace.
Peace. Good. So peace is not present in this Moshe Dayan ed. Why? Because the alignment is trying to have its cake and eat it too. It's trying to attract voters who are happy with greater Israel, and they know that Dayan favors a heavy Israeli presence in the territories, and so his slogan is, destiny has demanded of us, so we're willing to sacrifice for the greater cause of the Jewish people and a state. And no mention is made of painful concessions, of peace, of diplomacy. Forget all that. It's tough, but we're going to do it, and we're going to hold on to the territories. It's very amorphous, but for those who want to read into it a tough right-wing approach, you have it right here. Now let's go to something of a middle approach. Yigal Alon. Okay, so for those who were the former Achdut people, Lehikon lamilchama ki'ilu hi bilti nimnat, to prepare for war as though it were unavoidable. Lachtor l'shalom ki'ilu hu behesed yad, and to pave the way for peace as though it were at hand. So this is mentioning both war and peace, which is not surprising because Achdut Avodah classically was very activist in the military sense. You know, he was a fighter by nature, but also one who wanted to pursue peace. So notice, we're going to prepare for war as though it were unavoidable or inevitable. And bear in mind, many people believe that. The war of attrition was ongoing. Hundreds of soldiers had died before this election took place in the war of attrition, which began in April of 69 and would not end until August of 70. So we have to think about war, but also you have to think about peace. And peace will mean some sort of concession, most presumably territorial withdrawal, and a massive one at that. But under the right conditions, Yigal Alon would go for it. Now we go to Abba Ibn. I can't imagine that there were too many people voting for the alignment because of Abba Ibn, but he was an important voice. He was the foreign minister, and so he gets his face on an ad. Anu misavim levater al hesegei habitachon, umesavim levater al sikuya shalom. We refuse to give up on our security gains. Now, notice he doesn't say territorial gains, security gains, however, whatever that means. But we also refuse to give up on the chances for peace. So notice, Eban's ad is, there actually are chances for peace. Yigal Alon's ad was, if it happens, let's be in favor of peace. But he doesn't actually say there are any real possibility of it at the moment. And Dayan leaves out peace altogether. So each of these ads fits the political profile of the person whose image appears on the ad. And they're not necessarily contradictory, but they don't have the same thrust. And it goes to show you that the alignment was not of ideologically homogeneous. There was a wide gamut of people running in that party.
Israel was the same way. Huh? You have to be realistic. You have to put a group like this together because that's the way Jews are.
Ah. No, but other parties had within their platform a specific agenda for the territories or for a peacemaking or for war making. This is all over the map, literally and figuratively. Right, so in 1969, it's unclear what the other side of the aisle, the Arabs, are thinking, what they're going to do. The future is a complete unknown. All right, so election's over.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about that now. So the Americans were pressuring Israel in the direction of peace. Secretary of State William Rogers had a plan, and then he had a second plan. In 1969 was the first one, 1970 was the second one, and then there was UN mediation under Gunnar Jarring, the Swedish diplomat. All this was going nowhere, and the reason it was going nowhere is because Israel was insisting upon things that Nasser and then later Sadat were not willing to give. Israel, under Golda Meir, wanted two things. One, an indefinite ceasefire, not a temporary ceasefire, to the war of attrition. And the Egyptians were only willing to give her some limited 90-day or 180-day ceasefire. The second thing was direct face-to-face negotiations, something that the Egyptians had preferred to avoid, and the Syrians would always want to avoid. Eventually, this would happen at the end of the Yom Kippur War at kilometer 101, and then more in a more diplomatic fashion at the Geneva Conference in December of 73. But up in 69 and 70, the Arab states, and especially Egypt, are not ready to go that far to meet an Israeli across the table. They only want to have third-party mediation, and third-party mediation for a temporary truce that involves a massive Israeli withdrawal. And Israel's not ready to do that, even especially under circumstances of fighting at the canal, which was fierce. Okay.
Nobody brought up the West Bank. Nobody brought up Jerusalem.
No, because that the Palestinian issue is something for which there's no ready solution. On the one hand, Israel is in talks with King Hussein. King Hussein makes periodic trips to Tel Aviv secretly to meet with Golda Meir. He made about five or six of them during Golda's tenure as prime minister. But he wants the totality of the West Bank, including a chunk of Jerusalem, and it's unclear, even if that was on the table to be given to him, that he could make the first move without another Arab state preempting, because he's the weak Hashemite kingdom of Jordan, and Egypt and Syria are much larger. It was often a thought that Egypt had to be the first one, and as a matter of historical fact, Egypt was the first one. So King Hussein was very weak, therefore nothing happened. And as for the PLO, Israel wouldn't talk to the PLO. Golda was very much opposed to Palestinian nationalism. Golda denied the existence of a Palestinian people, which got her in a lot of trouble with the Americans, but that was her point of view. There is no such thing as a Palestinian people. So in 1970, in the spring of 1970, something was cooking on the peace agenda. Nachum Goldman claimed that he was invited by Nasser to go to Cairo to discuss peace. Who's Nachum Goldman?
Oh, is he the rich guy in Congress?
So he was the president of the World Jewish Congress. If you recall, I've mentioned his name once before in our series of lectures. And that was in 1947 at the UN partition plan when on November 26, 1947, it looked like partition was going to fail. Nachum Goldman asked his friends among the Argentinian and South American delegations to go back up to the rostrum and give more speeches. And they said, we gave all of our speeches. So he said, go up and read the Bible, or read the phone book, just do something and get us to 6 o'clock and we'll postpone until November 29th. That was his major contribution, for which he gets a portion in Gan Eden. But, he did something bad here in 1970. He told Golda about the possibility of him going to Cairo for discussions, and he wanted her permission, so to speak. And that was offensive because Goldman didn't live in Israel. He actually lived in New York. He was one of the only major Zionist figure, a Hebrew-speaking Zionist figure, who didn't actually move to Israel after the state was founded. Everybody else, you know, lived in Eretz Israel, became an Israeli. He didn't. And it showed in what happened here.
He
was president of the World Jewish Congress for a long time. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so he wanted permission. Now, Golda's response is, you're a citizen of another country. You're a Jew. I'm not the leader of world Jewry. You know, you're just some guy. What are you coming to me for? The Israeli government isn't giving you permission to speak in our name. If you want to go, go, but you don't represent us. So I don't know what you're going to talk about. I don't think so. He was a front for himself.
Covered
Gadol. And he decided not to go. Having been scorned by Golda, he didn't go. But then he wrote a series of articles in Haaretz and then a foreign affairs magazine in which he claimed that Israel was being too obstructionist and that going forward, Israel should rely upon international guarantees for its security, not upon its military might. When Golda read that, she went through the roof, and she said to her colleagues in the cabinet, there's not an ounce of Zionism left in the man. That was her response. So, this had a very negative impact on the government, and on Golda in particular, because the public was aware that a chance for peace with Egypt was dismissed. And so, the next week, you have the Shministim, the letter of the 12th graders, the 12th graders' letter, that about 100 kids in 12th grade who were going to be conscripted into the army that fall wrote a letter saying, how could we serve in the army when what you're asking us to do is to be an army of occupation in a situation where there were prospects for peace and those prospects are being rejected summarily without being taken seriously. So how could we serve in the army when this is no longer the army of our parents' generation? This is a different story altogether. We're not comfortable with this.
Who is behind that?
Yeah. Kids. 17, 18-year-old kids. Yes.
People have it now.
All right, so Golda and Yigal Alon and some of the other members of the cabinet met with these 12th graders, and they explained to them the situation, that it's life is a little bit more complicated than you think. You know, you're just kids, you don't really know. When you get older, you'll understand more. And everybody ended up serving. There was another letter supporting the government from other 12th graders. So, you know, right-wingers as opposed to left-wingers. So it all ended up amounting to nothing, but I bring it up because it's a nice historical footnote. It's the beginning of questioning at the significant level whether or not young people would be willing to serve in the army. And some people actually refusing, conscientious objection. Okay. Next piece. So, the war of attrition doesn't go very well for Israel. More soldiers died in that war than in the Six-Day War. Something had to give to end it. And Rogers' second overture for some sort of peace deal is what sealed the deal. On August 7th, 1970, Israel agreed to a ceasefire. It was a temporary one, not an indefinite one, and it was based upon indirect mediation, not face-to-face negotiations. So Golda caved in on the two things that she was holding out on, the nature of the negotiations and the length of the ceasefire. She also lost out on keeping together her national unity government, which was important to her. She wanted to sustain the wall-to-wall coalition. But Gachal, under Menachem Begin, felt compelled to leave because the Rogers plan called for respected and secure borders, but not the post-67 expansive borders. So there was going to be a territorial withdrawal as part of the Rogers plan. And because Gachal could not countenance that, they left. They went into the opposition. So the National Unity Government lasted 3 years and 2 months, to be exact, which is a fairly long time. And now Menachem is back as the head of the Oppositia. Okay. Let's now talk about something else entirely. Some social issues, and maybe religion and state issues. So in 1970, you had the Benjamin Shalit episode. Who was Benjamin Shalit? He was a naval officer. What was his claim to fame? That he married a
Shiksa?
Exactly. Okay, yeah. So he married a non-Jew, and they had children, and he wanted to register the children as Jews by ethnicity. He was a confirmed atheist and didn't care if the religion on the identity cards didn't say anything, but for nationality, he wanted them to be Israeli. So it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in his favor. And unlike in the United States, where when the Supreme Court rules, that's the end of it, in Israel, the Knesset can override the Supreme Court. So the coalition, led by the National Religious Party, insisted upon changing the bureaucratic rules for identity on the Tahudat Zehut, that you have to be halakhically Jewish to have that the Jewish identity by nationality. And it won. It passed the Knesset, and so only if you're born of a Jewish mother or a halachic convert to Judaism can you have the Jewish nationality on the card. So Shalit lost. And Ad HaYom HaZeh, you have people complaining about, Jewish father, non-Jewish mother, the kid is living an Israeli lifestyle, but they don't have the Yehudi on the Lahum. So what was Golda's position as the prime minister, as the head of the government? So she's no Fruma, she's no religious person, but she recognizes that you can't pick all the battles in matters of religion and state. You can't fight them all. You have to be careful when you're going to fight these battles. And she wanted the National Religious Party to be in the coalition. So, and also it would be very difficult to maintain the government if the National Religious Party, after Gachal had left, if they were to leave too, so there's not a lot of wiggle room. She said, fine, we'll vote for this. And so the alignment, the secular alignment, voted for was basically an orthodox bill in favor of halachic status for the Lo'um on the national identity card.
You may have mentioned this before when we were talking about it. What's the advantage of having Jew on your identity card as opposed to not having Jew?
I would imagine when you're stopped on the highway, it's better to say that you're Jewish.
Okay.
I mean, if you look like you come from Norway, it might not make a difference. But it's better to say you're a Jew. If it doesn't say it, people get suspicious. Okay, next piece. Let's talk about... Yeah.
Understood.
America certainly was a lot more religious.
But in Israel, in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a significant percentage of the population that was avowedly atheist and very much opposed the role of religion in society. It was not a major talking point until the 1980s and the coalition politics of the late 80s when the Lubavitcher Rebbe got involved, 1988 election. And then nowadays, it's an important topic. But in 1970, it had not been, up until that point, a major bone of contention between the various factions. Religion and state was an issue in 48, 49, 50 when the state was first being established of what the Shabbos laws are going to be, the Kashrus laws, but for about 20 years, it was off the radar. Other things were the focus of attention. It would become one, yes. Okay, so now let's talk about the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers scared Golda. She feared their influence on society. And what's going on? So, the Black Panther movement began in March of 1971 when certain elements of the population accused the government of ignoring the hard living conditions of Sephardic Jews. And the specific neighborhood where it got started was the Musrara neighborhood in Jerusalem. What's the story of the Musrara neighborhood in Jerusalem? Where is it? Where is that neighborhood? I don't know. Who's been there? You've probably all been there. Okay, it's on the other side of the road that divides between east and west, just across from Mea Shearim. It was the only section of Jerusalem that was like an eastern part of Jerusalem that was in pre-67 Israel. I mean, aside from Mount Scopus, but it was just north of the new gate to the old city. So before 1947...
That's where Notre Dame is? Around there?
Not far.
I know you.
So
Mandelbaum Gate was around there?
Right near Mandelbaum Gate, yeah. Just near Mandelbaum Gate.
So,
before 1947, that neighborhood was a wealthy Arab neighborhood. But the Arab population was moved out, or moved themselves out, and so it was empty at that point. And the state of Israel moved Sephardic Jews, especially Moroccan Jews, into the abandoned buildings, and people lived there from 1949 to 1967, but it wasn't a very desirable neighborhood because it was a border neighborhood. There were Jordanian snipers on your head. I mean, the border was literally your backyard, your wall, the back wall of your house. So it was not a comfortable place to live. Dire poverty. The government neglected the residents there. Not good. After 1967, something changed. Well, the wall came down. Mandelbaum Gate is no more. And this neighborhood, which is on the seam between east and west of Jerusalem, is going to become gentrified. It's become a high-priced neighborhood, maybe. Who's moving in? Well, who's moving to Israel in the late 60s? Jews from what part of the world? Soviet bloc countries other than Russia. Not Russia itself, but from Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary. So Soviet bloc countries... Jews are moving in. Romania. So what's going to happen now? The government builds buildings and gives these Ashkenazic Jews comfortable housing. Hands it to them, effectively. And the Moroccan Jews who had been there from before were complaining that for 20 years you ignored our plight, and now the white Jews are moving in, and you're giving them everything, all the benefits of Aliyah. So, big, big complaint. Where do they go to complain? Huh? Doesn't matter where the money came from. The point is that people who are brand new to the country are going to have better living conditions than those who have been there for a long time. And those who were felt slighted are going to do something about it. So where do they complain? To City Hall. How far is City Hall from Masrara? It's right there. It's right across from Kikartzal. So, and it's not the fancy area that you have today. It was an old rundown building back then. So, the protest happens on March 2nd, 1971. And there are arrests made even before the protest gets underway. Why did this happen? Because the government didn't want riots. And the government wanted to shut this down before it got out of control. This was a bit unfair, because there had been protest rallies by Ashkenazic protest movements all throughout the 1960s, notably Matzpen, which was a socialist-slash-Marxist, anti-Zionist intellectual movement of high school and college-age students. And the Matzpen people said, you know, we always rallied against the government, but nobody was arrested preemptively. We had our protest, and maybe if we got out of hand, somebody got arrested. But the government and the police didn't swoop in before anything happened and put handcuffs on us. So again, the Sephardim complained, for the Matzpen, you let them rally. For us, you put the handcuffs before we even get started. Who showed up to this rally? So there were about 300 people. But most of the people there were not Musrara residents. Most of them were either intellectuals, who were like fellow traveler types, foreign students, and tourists, who came to watch what's going on. I can sympathize with this. Remember, a year ago, we went to the rally outside of Bibi's house. I'm not there to rally for the reform movement of Jews. I was just there just to see what's going on, because I like to see what's going on. So again, students and tourists go to these sorts of things just to see what's happening. And there were a lot of arrests made. Well, the next thing is a hunger strike. A hunger strike will get the government's attention, right? And where are you going to do the hunger strike?
The Prime Minister's house.
No, where do you get the most attention if you're a Jew doing a hunger strike?
In front of a restaurant.
Huh? No. Somebody said it.
Kotel?
At the Kotel, right, bingo. You do a hunger strike at the Kotel. How could the world ignore that? So they do the hunger strike, and Golda agrees to meet with the leadership of this movement. Who are the leaders of this movement? Well, some of the names might sound familiar to you. Charlie Bitton, Sadia Marciano, Reuven Abergil, Meir Levy, and Kochavi Shemesh were five of the leaders. Charlie Bitton and Sadia Marciano are probably the most famous of all of them, because they would later go on to serve in the Knesset. Golda and Yigal Alon and some of the others who were in the room were not really talking to these boys. They were talking at them. This was not a conversation so much as it was each side getting its piece in and not really listening to the other party. The protesters, Bitton and Marciano and the others, they were claiming, we represent the thousands of forgotten Sephardic Jews who the government has ignored and hasn't cared about. And it's not about us and our personal lives, it's about the movement. And we represent the movement, so take us seriously. Whereas Golda said, no, you're just five kids between the ages of 18 and 21 who don't go to school, don't have jobs, some of you have a criminal record, you're just a bunch of hooligans who got my attention for 5 minutes. And so she starts asking them questions. Do you go to school? No. When did you drop out of school? Third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. Do you work? No. Did you try to work? No. Did you know that you had to work? No. So she was looking down upon them as like nothing from nowhere. They were nobodies who were just worthy of having an arrest rap sheet. So this meeting did not go very well. Some of them had not. Some of them had not. Well, since the little progress is being made at this April 13th meeting, they need to have another big rally. So they start putting up protest signs. And they use the Black Panther name, Dafka, to frighten Golda. Because Golda was afraid, she knew about the Black Panthers in America and knew they were anti-Semitic. And she said to the Black Panthers in Israel, don't you know that the name of the organization you took is anti-Semitic? And they said, yeah, we know, we want to scare you. And Golda wasn't racist at all. You know, Golda was big in Africa. They loved her over there. It wasn't an issue of black or race. It was just a disconnect. So the signs came out. Golda, teach us Yiddish. Or Mama Russia. They called her Mama Russia. Not Russia, Reish Shin Ayin, but R-U-S-S-I-A. So on the night of the Panthers, they had the big rally, May 18th, 1971. There were 5,000 protesters going down Jaffa Road from Davidka Square to Zion Square. So it's about six, seven blocks going down the hill. And Molotov cocktails were thrown at the police. The demand was that the name of Kikar Tzion be changed to Kikar Yahadut Mizrach, the Kikar of the Eastern Jewry, you know, Mizrahi Jewry. Golda then said, people who throw Molotov cocktails at Jewish policemen are not nice. The expression, they're not nice, became a famous expression that was used against her, that she was too condescending towards the Mizrahi Jews and saying they're not nice. Also, she referred to them as boys instead of men. Now, the truth of the matter is that they were very young. She's a 75-year-old grandmother, and they were 19-year-old kids who were being involved in hooliganism. So what do you want from her? But there was the terminology led people to think that she was dismissive of Sephardic Jewry generally. Then there are claims of police brutality. The police used water cannon against the protesters, and the water was dyed green. So a lot of the people came away from the episode, even the ones who weren't arrested, all discolored and all that.
It was green.
Yeah, yeah. So, in June, and some of them tried to invade her house, the Prime Minister's residence on Rehov Ben Maimon, Arambam. They went up King George, past the Prima King's Hotel, all right, down Ben Maimon Arambam to the Prime Minister's residence, and they broke a couple of windows, and they tried to get in. But Golda later said, don't worry, they weren't trying to hurt me, they were just trying to overturn the furniture. So it wasn't no harm, no foul. Okay. In June, there was another protest rally. And this time, the posters had clenched fist salutes to really copy what had been going on in America. And the sign said, Golda, get lost already. Everyone's had enough of you. Or, a state in which half the population are kings and the other half are exploited slaves will end up in flames. Whoa, that's tough language. And there was they burned Golda in effigy. A naked figurine of her with wings, with angel's wings, was burned on fire. This is getting out of hand. So something has to be done. Okay, so I'll stop and clarify what's going on here. Usually, Sephardic Jewry in Israel, from a religio-political point of view, are traditionalists in their either belief system or gut feeling, and right of center politically on matters of war and peace, and also because they felt that Gachal was giving them an attentive ear, whereas the alignment Mapai was ignoring them. So they're rightists and they're traditionalists. But that's not everyone. There were some, a small percentage, but not insignificant, that went the total other way, went against Judaism, against religion, and became extreme far leftists, communists who believed in anti-Zionism. So these folks in the Black Panthers, including the ones who went to Parliament, to the Knesset a decade later, they went to the Knesset under Chadash. What's Chadash? That's a communist party. So these are people who have very different orientation politically and religiously from what you assume is your typical Sephardic Jew in Israel.
Was this the seed of the later one we took
over? So the answer to that is everyone knew since the early 50s that the Sephardic population was gravitating towards the right side of the aisle. But so long as the Mapai was still and the Histadrut were the basis for getting a job and advancing in society, that was a check upon the extent to which Gachal or later Likud could infiltrate the Sephardic electorate. they made enough headway by 1977 to win. This episode says, well, they don't capture everybody's attention. There is a small group that runs the other direction, that runs towards radical left and undermining the state of Israel, the Jewish character of the state and the state bichlal. Okay. So, did the government do anything to foment all of this? And the answer is yes. At the time, nobody knew, and even as recently as 10 years ago, people didn't know this, but the archives were opened up, and it turns out that one of the leaders of the Black Panthers, who was about twice the age of everybody else, he was 40, so he was an old-timer at that age compared to the 20-year-olds, was Yaakov Elbaz, and he was a government plant in the Panthers. In exchange for him riling up the crowd and getting them to use Molotov cocktails, which would discredit the movement as being overly violent, the police agreed to ignore his prostitution ring that he was running. As was the case with the FBI in the United States, where they would rile up certain left-wing groups but with outside agitators who really were not true ideologues, just looking to cause trouble and get paid for their efforts, so too was the case here. The thinking being that if violence is used against Jewish police officers, this movement will have no credibility. Okay, what ultimately happens? So the Prime Minister establishes the Prime Minister's Committee for Children and Youth in Distress, and the goal was to alleviate poverty and certain social problems of people who are delinquent in the educational system or running into trouble with the law in teenage years. So from 1971 to 73, changes are made. And significant progress is made. By the summer of 1973, even the Panthers themselves would acknowledge that we're in a better place here. But they gave no credit to Golda. They gave credit to themselves and to other members of the committee who were doing good work. But as for Golda, she'll forever be remembered as the old Ashkenazic lady who ignored the plight of the Sephardim. Okay. Charlie Bitton was in the Knesset from 1977 to 1990 under Chadash, and then under the Black Panther name between 1990 and 1992. He's still alive. He's in his early 70s. And then Sadio Marciano was in the Left Camp of Israel faction of the parliament in 1980. In 1973, the next election cycle, the Black Panthers ran on their own ticket, and they won 0.9% of the vote. Now, 0.9% is not nothing. It's nothing. The problem for them was it's below the threshold. You needed at that time 1% to get into the Knesset, and they didn't get it. But still, plenty of people voted for them. These were not regarded as total loonies. They're Jews, so I wouldn't say they're anti-Semitic, but they were definitely anti-Zionist. Oh, that can happen. Okay. So let's, in the few minutes we have left, let's discuss some of the more broader diplomatic and political issues. So, in September of 1970, Black September, King Hussein is in trouble. The PLO is rebelling against his rule. And Syria is invading Jordan from the north. Who will save King Hussein? Who's in a position to save King Hussein? Who wants to save King Hussein? The Americans would prefer that the Hashemite dynasty not go down because Jordan was a reliable ally, or semi-reliable ally, and had not fallen into the Soviet orbit. But the Americans are nowhere to be found. The Sixth Fleet is out to sea. What are they going to do to save Jordan? Israel is the only country that can save Jordan. With some airplanes flying over northern Jordan and southern Syria, the IAF could turn back the Syrian invasion. But the question from Israel's point of view is, should they do it? They certainly could do it, and in the end they would, but should they do it? Is it in the better interests of Israel to maintain the Hashemite dynasty or to see what else might happen? Maybe, you could argue, a PLO takeover of Jordan would mean that there is a Palestinian state in Jordan, and then alleviate the pressure on making a separate Palestinian state in the West Bank. So that's the thinking of some in the leadership brass. So,
but even at that time, didn't they know that Palestinian Liberation Organization wanted the destruction or the overrun of Israel?
Yes, everyone knows that. But it's not regarded as a realistic thing.
Sounds like appeasement.
It's appeasement at somebody else's expense, not Israel's expense. In other words, if the Jordanians fall, so The PLO win, but they win. Somebody else loses. We're okay. So who was in favor of what? Yigal Alon, Golda, and Yitzhak Rabin favored saving King Hussein and avoiding a Syrian invasion and a PLO takeover. Golda and Hussein had decent relations. Dayan vacillated. Dayan, as the defense minister, was unsure that this was a good idea. In the end, he was overruled by the majority of the cabinet, and it happened. On the issue of the West Bank, there was one important piece I left out last time in discussing the various options for the territories. As I mentioned, Dayan was in favor of an entrenched Israeli presence on the Sumerian and Judean highlands, which others disagreed with and thought was the height of folly. But Dayan had an important point. He said the Yigal Alon plan, which was to annex the uninhabited portions of the West Bank and leave the heavily Arab areas in the hands of the Arabs, he said the Alon plan was like the white paper. How is it like the white paper? The white paper of 1939. What did the white paper do?
It restricted immigration
to Eretz Israel, and it restricted land purchases, and it restricted Jewish settlement in regions of western Eretz Israel, western Palestine. So, Dayan's point is, we conquered Eretz Israel. The government, how could the government forbid Jews from living anywhere in Eretz Israel? If you're going to do that, you might as well forbid the study of the Bible in school. This was maybe the most far-sighted point that anyone ever made in that whole tkufa, that whole era. Meaning, we don't know how long the occupation of the West Bank is going to last. In 1967, 8, 9, 70, nobody knows it's going to take 50 years. As far as they know, it could be resolved, you know, after half a decade or a decade. But so long as it continues and a Jewish state controls the historic Jewish homeland, it's going to prove impossible to prevent ideologically zealous Jews from settling all over Eretz Israel. How is the government going to stop that? Even if you wanted to stop it, you couldn't. Practically and morally. How could you prevent a Jew from living wherever they want in Judea, in Eretz Israel? It's like the British white paper all over again. So Begin was a firm believer in settling all over the West Bank, including in sensitive areas which are heavily Arab, and because he's of that mind. What Dayan is saying is that it's going to prove impossible, and maybe we shouldn't even want to prevent Jews from going wherever they're going to go. So what's the solution then? A quick political settlement. Because if having Jews in the heartland of Samaria is an objectively bad idea, as they would argue, then you have to relinquish control, because so long as you have it, then Jews are going to move there. Well, there was no counter-argument to this. There can be no counter-argument to it. It's like in the Bible, the story of Shechem and Dina, where the brothers say, "Hachazonaya se'et achotenu," shall our sister be treated like a harlot? And what does Yaakov respond? He doesn't respond. He says nothing. You can't respond to this argument. How could you stop Jews from moving anywhere in Eretz Israel? The answer is you can't, and they won't. Eventually, by the mid-70s. At this point, they still will try. But long-term, it's going to prove impossible. Okay, 1972. What happens in 72? What's the big episode of that year? The Munich Olympics. Golda was in a very tough spot after the Munich Olympics. Because, remember, in 1962, 63... what was one of her big criticisms of David Ben-Gurion?
That he settled with the Germans?
Correct. That he was cozying up with West Germany, with Konrad Adenauer, and making arrangements for transfer of military supplies, and even the training of IDF officers in Germany. And that was too much for Golda to handle, personally, and what she felt politically, that the Mapai would look bad if everybody knew how close a relationship Ben-Gurion's Israel had with Bonn and with West Germany. So now, in 72, after the Germans attempt to rescue the hostages, of course they fail, but they tried, So Golda has to say, well, at least they tried. This was not the old Germany. This was Ben-Gurion's new Germany, other Germany. They made a good faith effort. It just didn't go well.
But the fact that they didn't want Israel to go ahead and try a rescue, that didn't come into the conversation.
That may never have been a realistic option. But then she had a problem. It came out about 2 weeks or 3 weeks later that the German rescue attempt was half-baked, and it made no sense. It was tactically totally flawed, and it was executed so poorly that it was you could argue no serious attempt was made to save the lives of the hostages. Although it looked like there was an attempt, there really was no attempt. This was all a bluff. It had no chance of success. They did. I think they lost one or two. Policemen, not soldiers. So that angered her. And then, after the plane hijacking and the last three of the terrorists being released to Algeria, and it being thought that this was prearranged, although that's never been proven, it may not even be true, but the thinking was it might have been prearranged. So now she thinks, well, the Germans are horrible. They really are the old Germany. And this is the worst ever. So she was made to look foolish because she had said favorable things about them, now thinking the worst about them. In 1973, she had multiple meetings with Willy Brandt, who, as a socialist, a like-minded socialist, he got along with Golda, and they tried to smooth things over. But it was a tough go of it for her because she, in her heart, did not want to have good relations with Germany. But the position of prime minister sort of forced her to play the role of, you know, well-behaved diplomat. Okay. What about punishing the PLO for the act of terrorism? So Operation Wrath of God, Zam Ha'el, was Golda's decision, and the cabinet would not be involved in the selection of targets for assassination, but rather there'd be a Committee X. And who was on this Committee X? The Prime Minister and three other members of the cabinet, but the rest of the cabinet will not be told. It was better for plausible deniability that fewer people know what's going on. So only a handful of people ever knew who was on the list to be assassinated. Okay, in the last 2 minutes we have left, let's talk about... Huh? It's unclear. And it may have changed as the year went along before they stopped the operation after the botched episode in Lillehammer in Norway. Okay, in 1973, Golda bows to the party's wishes and agrees to become the prime ministerial candidate again in the next election cycle. Remember, you're not allowed to have political ambition. You have to just do what the party says. So they tell her, we need you again, so she graciously accepts. And she gives three reasons why she's accepting this time. She's 75 years old, maybe she should retire. So she argues, one, the coming year will be critical for U.S.-Israeli relations, which is something she said the last time, and that she alone can deal with Richard Nixon. Okay, and Richard Nixon and her had a good relationship. Two, let's avoid a big fight over a successor. So who were the potential successors? In 1969, it was Yigal Alon and Moshe Dayan. The same two guys could be successors this time, although now there are other people in the fray, notably Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin, who ultimately will be the two candidates after Golda resigns. And thirdly, retirement would kill her. If she retires, what is she going to do? Go home and knit blankets? She's not going to do that. So she would die if she were out of politics. Therefore, she has to stay in the thick of things. Over the summer, the political season gets underway. And it's now time for electioneering again. The election is set for October of 1973. Will it actually happen in October? No, there'll be a war instead.
December, right?
December 31st. It was postponed 2 months. But the last thing that she says, that towards the end of the summer, Labor Day weekend, when the sloganeering is at its height, the following message. Quiet reigns on the banks of the Suez. The lines are secure. The bridges are open. Jerusalem is united. New settlements are springing up and our political position is strong. You know, only the labor alignment can achieve this. And with your help, it shall continue. So this is a very rosy picture of what's going on. Remember, for 3 years, the Suez Canal had been quiet. The War of Attrition ended, and it really was. There wasn't much going on. In fact, if you wanted to have an easy military service, where did you go? To the canal, to the Bar-Lev line. Not much was happening. It was a lot easier than chasing Palestinian terrorists in the West Bank. So, things look good. Economy was pretty good. New settlements are opening up, both in pre-67 Israel and beyond in the territories, in the northern Sinai and in the West Bank and on the Golan Heights. So, the argument is the labor alignment has done very good. I mean, if in 69 the argument was we want a war, then in 73 the argument is going to be there hasn't been a war in a while and life is pleasant. So let's continue. Why rock the boat by bringing in Gachal, or as it would then be called, Likud, which is a warmongering party and had opposed the ceasefire to end the war of attrition. The last thing that I'll mention for tonight was on September 13th, 1973, there was a dogfight over Syria, over the Golan Heights, between Israeli and Syrian jets, and Israel lost one and the Assyrians lost eight. And so this was seen as a major success, that despite Syrian desire to mess around with Israel, they got kicked in the head. And so the labor alignment's argument was, the planes we used to win are planes we got from the Americans because we were flexible in accepting the Rogers Plan ceasefire of 70. If Gachal had had their way, if the Likud had had their way, and we rejected the ceasefire, we'd still have been fighting in the Sinai, and we wouldn't have American weapons. And if we don't have American weapons, we can't win like this, like we just won in the dogfight. So therefore, labor alignment behaves prudently, okay, strategically, with Seichel, as opposed to Gachal, which is just right-wing bluster and is going to get us nowhere. So we'll stop here. And next time...